Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, she made me feel like a god. That's when it got wheels off. The Polyphonic Spree is a 22-person extravaganza, but at its center is the brains and heart of the whole thing, the guru behind the spree, Tim DeLauder. I've known him since I was 20 years old, 19 years old. We came up together in the Dallas rock and roll scene. His band Tripping Daisy blew up in the 90s. In 2000, he formed the Spree, and it's been a real pleasure to watch him work, to watch him grow, to watch him explore his art, because it's very much art, this thing he does, these multimedia, visual, audio, lifestyle experiences that he's been creating low these many, many years. Their new record is pretty hardcore. It's very much a Polyphonic Spree event. And it's great, you know, as we say during the course of this conversation, it's something you're going to want to listen to with headphones on, start to finish. It's an experience. So I'm really glad that I got to catch up with an old friend on this episode of Wheels Off. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Tim DeLauder. Welcome to Wheels Off, Tim DeLauder. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Rhett. Thanks for having me on your show.
For the edification of our listeners, from where are you logging in?
I'm in Dallas, Texas, over the record store, Good Records, literally. I'm right below my feet is the store.
Great record store. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Congrats on the new record. It's incredible.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I'm pretty proud of it. You know, you get one of those records every now and then, you know, and it's like, you know, you put out records and you like them and they're good and all this. This one's different beyond anything I've ever put out. I'm really excited about it.
It's got to feel good to have something like that come along, because I don't know if you're like me, but you sometimes have the feeling like, what if nothing great ever comes along and all my work is in the past and here we are and you did it.
Yeah, no, man. I know that feeling really well. I guess anybody that's a songwriter, it's in this business, is, you know, you have those dry spells, but it was rough for me. I seriously thought it was over. Like it was, because it went on for some years, you know, kind of in a funk there, depression down, and just could not swing it. And it didn't help that I couldn't write. And it was brutal, really brutal. To be, you know, at my age and thinking, is this it? Am I done? You know?
I know, because we're still young. I
don't, yeah. But still, you know, I'm like, I should be able to like keep going, and it's not happening. And I'm like, is this, I really thought, man, is this it? I'm like, what am I going to go do? And like, I'm real handy. So I'm thinking, well, am I going to go be a carpenter? I'm going to go, what am I going to go do? You know, I thought it was over.
No, it's got to feel good, because this record really is so great. And the whole point of this is for you to talk. But I will tell you, the first time I heard Galloping Seas, the song off the new record, Jason Garner, who travels sometimes with the old 97s between Spree gigs, played it for us. And David Wilson, who also works with you, played it over the system. So we heard it over the PA system at a club. Like super loud, Galloping Seas, start to finish. And I swear to God, I've been sober 8 years. I felt like I was tripping. It was so beautiful and giant. What? Way to go, man.
Thank you so much, Rhett. Yeah, I heard that you played it a few times at your show. You know, I guess when you guys are coming off or going on or something, I don't know. But thank you for doing that. Yeah, that's a big old song. You know, it's one of the four that I wrote by myself during COVID, trying to teach myself logic. I've never engineered my own stuff. I've always had people around me that engineered, Mark Pirro or another friend, whoever. I'm just not that guy. And I'm technically savvy when it comes to engineering and all that. But during COVID, I thought, you know what? I've got this time. I'm going to go try to learn logic. So I bought the logic software. I had a computer and I'm like, I'm going to go dive in this and just try to see what I can do. And in the process of learning how to record, I had to record something with my guitar and just like playing, you know, and just strumming some chords. And how I write, I'll come back to that in a second, but how I write, because it'll explain more what I'm talking about, the teaching myself that. I'm not really one that sits around with a guitar in my hand. I don't kind of constantly try to write songs. It's merely like I pick the guitar up, it's by my head, I'll strum a chord, and it either promotes me to keep going improvising. And I improvise melody, music, and lyrics all at the same time. And I've always done it. So that's how I write. And so it either something happens and promotes me to go to the second and third chord and actually start singing. I get a visual there, or it doesn't. And I just set it down. So it's literally like drum, drum. And maybe I'll start singing, or I don't feel it. Nothing's happening. I just set it down. That's my relationship with the guitar. It's always been like that. And I know it's really strange to hear someone like me who's been making music over 30 years, but that's kind of how I teach treat instruments. They're more or less tools for me to, if the muse is there, I'm able to use that to express myself. So in the process of learning logic, I'm strumming it, and lo and behold, it started happening, and I happened to be recording. So I start recording and I come out with this song, and I think it was Give Me Everything was the first one. That's off Salvage Enterprise. And there was a verse and a chorus and kind of a way that, and I had a vision of what it was about, and the lyrics were there. It was clear. And I went back and started crafting. It was like, wow, okay, this is cool, man. I'm writing. It felt good. I started getting energy. And then I'm like, finished that song and kind of went and started another one, and just started happening. And I gave myself energy and this kind of positive reinforcement, like, my God, it felt so good just to write and like have something come out where it had been void for so long. We're talking years. And I've been in a bad place. And for that to happen was, my God, it saved my life, actually. So it's amazing that, you know, ultimately we do this as humans. We end up saving ourselves. And it was just a testament of that ability, but it happened to be recorded. So
I wonder how much the sort of being giving yourself permission because you were doing something different, like learning a new software and using a new tool. Basically, I wonder if that distraction or whatever gave you the space to make something, whereas before you had sort of been working with the same tools and feeling stunted.
You know, I don't know, Rhett, because once it's recording, there's really nothing else to do. So it's like, it's just recording. So I can be sitting in there and just like burning. It's all digital air, you know, it's like, I'm just doing it. And so I guess it gave me for whatever reason, where my brain was, and I guess it was occupied at the time of learning that, but at the same time, it was so quiet in there. It was just me by myself, and just the process of learning that stuff and then having just a bit of an intimacy that was just with myself and just kind of playing, it just happened. And yeah. You never predict when that stuff's going to happen. You just kind of like, it just happens. And everything was just the timing, everything was right. And it was everything I needed in my life at that point. And so the rest of the record just It all came from that genesis of that moment. And then I had some other songs in my phone. Like when I do, you know, pick up the guitar and I'll play. And like, I always click record on the phone in case I capture something. So I had these like little things that I had, like a verse and a chorus and a general idea of what the song was about, melody and lyric. It's all there. And so I went back and visited those with Julie, and Julie's kind of going through them, and she goes, God, these are kind of in the same world. They kind of go with your other ones. And before we knew it, we had a collection of songs mixed with the four that I'd done myself, which, by the way, are the ones on the record. I actually engineered my own songs that are on this. So I've never done that before. So that was kind of cool. So what you hear on there is what I actually recorded myself of those, which is Wishful, Brave and True, Open the Shores, Give Me Everything. Galloping Seas is one we re-recorded, but those three are the ones that are actually on the record.
Wow.
So,
dude, that's so cool. So was that the salvaging part, the digging through the old phone memos?
You know what? There's a lot of different ways of looking at Salvage Enterprise, but to be honest with you, it actually comes from my dad's business back when I was a kid. Was called Salvage Enterprise. It was an unclaimed freight business back then in the 70s. This is before you had Big Lots and all these other stores that are huge kind of commercial stores. But you had a few guys in Dallas that were going to these trucking companies and railroad companies and buying their damaged goods. So through transportation, if a pallet fell over, they would write off the whole pallet, even though maybe two boxes were destroyed on the whole pallet. So you had, you know, 80% of this whole pallet was great and 20% was garbage, but you still could sell it. So these guys developed a business, an unclaimed freight business, salvage business. And those were kind of, there was about four of them in Dallas, and my dad had one. And it's a bunch of entrepreneur guys that saw an opportunity to make some money, and they created this business. So as a kid, I worked there. All my friends are out playing in the yard. I'm actually working at the place and actually ran the place as a kid. A lot of the guys, this is, you know, when I was younger, a lot of the guys that he was running around with, their kids were running the places. And I'm talking like 14-year-old people. Myself, I'm 12 to 14 running this business while my dad's not there, and it's just me. And I'm like, there was a retail side that we'd open for the public, and then the other side was like bigger stuff and chemicals and things that they would sell on the phone. Anyway, Salvage Enterprise always meant to me everything under the sun, because it was literally everything that was being shipped on our highways and railroads. You would have everything from cymbals to pharmaceuticals, from airplane parts to, you know, groceries, to literally whatever is being shipped on our roads and railroads. So anything could come in there. It was so exciting when he would go and buy these lots, because a lot of times he wouldn't even know what he's getting. And we'd bring it to the warehouse. We'd open it up and start going through it. And like, oh my God, we got this and got this. And it was always an exciting part. So it's part of my childhood. It also, you know, I equate it to everything under the sun. And then it's also like kind of salvaging what we do with ourselves anyway. We're always constantly salvaging and keeping and trying to make better. So.
Well, it feels like such a metaphor in there too, right? That this stuff that's just thrown away as garbage and written off has value.
Totally. Yeah. I loved it. You know, of course it was taken over in the '80s and nineties, when we came all these big corporate stores, and they got hip to it and pushed all these little guys out. But, yeah.
So I wonder, you know, you're growing up, you're working at perhaps too young of an age, some might say, and like an actual job. Was there a moment when you knew it was going to be rock and roll for you? Was there an epiphany moment? Did you always know? What was the genesis of your calling?
Most definitely. I vividly remember it. I was went to Lakewood Elementary here in Dallas, and I had a music teacher named Mrs. Simon, who I've described. She's got this jet black hair in a bun, these big round horn rim glasses, black. She wore a pantsuit skirt every day, and just all business, no fun. Nothing about her class was fun. It's music. You're thinking, oh my God, it was like a downer being in there. It just wasn't cool at all. One day she comes in completely out of the blue and she walks in with this album and she sets it up on the chalkboard and she goes, "We're just going to listen to this record today." She'd never done anything remotely like this before. And it was these three guys' profile on the album cover. And it was Emerson, Lake and Palmer, the trilogy record. And she pulls out the record player, puts the record on and starts playing it. For whatever reason, man, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I was like, oh my God, this one song in particular, which is Hoedown. It's an instrumental. We've heard it. Everyone's heard it before, renditions of it. But it just hit me, man. It was so broad and such a journey. And I loved the kind of musical landscape where it took me as a kid. I'd never heard music like that before because I was growing up on FM radio and didn't really hear that kind of stuff. And it was, I think it had a combination with her being so not like that, that when she did something out of ordinary, which was this stern taskmaster kind of person, it caught me off guard and I was open, receptive to it. But I literally remember saying to myself, I want to do this. I want to do this right here. And I talked to another friend who was there and kind of the similar experience. And we're still friends to this day. He goes, "My dad plays guitar. Maybe we should try to like make a band or whatever." And so I'm like, "Yeah, let's do it." And I didn't have any instruments, but I thought, you know, Baskin Robbins is down the street and they've got those ice cream buckets and maybe I can get some buckets from them and then I'll bolt them together and I'll make these drums. So I walked to Baskin Robbins. I got four of these buckets and I bolted them together and I painted them black and white and we kind of got together and jammed and wrote a song called Sing Along With My Tambourine. And this is in the fourth grade. And so we talked to our music teachers. You let us come and play the song. And it was like, the rest is history. This is what I want to do.
Wow. That's brilliant. Fourth grade.
Yeah. It's weird. It's like, you know, and I went back to Lakewood and I brought the spree and we played for the kids at the elementary school. And I told them that story because I said, you never know how this is going to come out. You like I'm doing right now on this stage, what I found that I wanted to do when I was sitting in that seat that you're sitting right now, looking at us at that age. It's like, it happens. Like you have these things that cross your path. And if you're open to it and you're like, if you go for what you're looking for like that, it just happens. And you just visualize it. And I was there to kind of inspire these kids, no matter, not just about music, but anything, whatever they want to do. And I'm a firm believer in that. And so it was really great to go back there and do that for those kids and talk about that.
I love that. I mean, you and I have a history that goes back over three decades. We were playing Tuesday night, ladies' night at the Rhythm Room with Tripping Daisy and whatever band I had at the Sleepy Heroes maybe at the time.
Right.
But I remember even back then being so impressed, amazed even by your sort of your work ethic, your commitment to it. Like you, in a way that nobody else on the scene was, you were taking it so seriously. Like, did it always feel to you like, this is a job? This is like something I'm going to show up every day and give everything I've got to this.
It wasn't like a job because I loved it so much. It was more like life or death for me. Like it had to happen these certain ways. The shows had to be like this. I always wanted to have visuals at the show. That was just as important to me as the music was at the time. You remember we were doing the visuals. Scott Berman was doing them. And that was just it's kind of like, you know, when you have these things that you want to try to execute, you see, it's like, once you've already seen it, it's like, it's going to happen. You just have to make it happen. It's like a tunnel vision. And that's why I kind of looked at that stuff back then. I still do, but back then it was intense. I just, this has got to happen. We got to do this. And it's like, I didn't think of it as work. It was just like, in order to complete the idea and to make the thing happen, I really enjoyed that aspect of it. And I think it has a lot to do, you know, I have a 20 something piece band. Who in their right mind would have a band like that or thinking they could tour a band like that? And here I'm 23 years later, you and I are talking and I'm in that band. But I think it has everything to do with how I was raised as a kid. You know, when I was Tony, I'm working at my dad's place and running the place at a young age. I just don't see things normally the way that other kids. I had to hitchhike to work after high school, which was unheard of. I'm on 408. We're living in Duncanville at the time. And it's like, I don't know. I think my upbringing had a lot to do with how I see the world and things that it's not that big of a deal. You just have to work and you just do this and you connect these things. And I saw that that's how life works back then. So I applied it, you know, even at that time. And so I was doing, you know, we were doing those kind of shows. You're right. No one was doing it. And it was so over the top, you know, we would take up 30 people's spaces in the clubs with those scaffoldings and things, and just this over the top thing that wasn't happening. But it was everything I kind of wanted to have people experience, that kind of show and all that kind of stuff. It just never seemed that big of a deal to me.
And it's, you've carried it on the new record. It feels very much, you've got a film component to it, and the visual aspect is still very much part of it.
Yeah. You know, after all these years, and Scott's coming back, and we're doing a planetarium experience that we're unveiling in February, March, where we're getting different animators from all over the place that are going to do live action and animation per song. And we're making this film that'll show in planetariums. So it's something we've been working on for about 6 months now. Real excited about it. So you'll go there and listen to the record, but you'll be looking at the visuals that's kind of telling the story.
Oh my God, that's insane.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about the sort of the dark period that led up to the new record. And I wonder, for you generally speaking, because it's cool for me having been able to watch your career from the beginning, and you've gone through a lot. I mean, I won't go through it all. Obviously, there's just been ups and downs.
Yeah.
You've survived like some really great stuff and some really tough stuff. I wonder though about the internally generated obstacles, like the stuff within you that keeps you from being your best self, doing your best work, the negative voices in your head that we all sort of deal with. For you, what have you, and I feel like it's funny for me asking you this question, because I feel like your body of work is like an opus, is like a thesis on how to deal with sort of the negative voices in your head and how to remain positive. What have you figured out as a human being, as an artist, as a way to get through those darker times, get past those negative voices?
You know, Rhett, it's hard no matter what, even though I know this more than anybody. And I tell myself, it's like when you are in in those times, it's like, I know that I'm going to come out of it. Eventually it's going to happen. It's just how we're wired. Humans ultimately want to be happy. They want to get what they need. And sometimes you lose sight of that because there's this self-doubt and you just start wallowing in it. It's really difficult. But even knowing that, it's hard sometimes that you can come out of it. But I just, you know, the irony is, the process of coming out of it happened on this record, which has never happened to me before. I always sing about things about reaching for this and you can overcome this. And, you know, these are things that I have to always had to tell myself. And it's just what I sing about, because I improvise and I sing off with the top of my head things that I think about. And it's just that, yeah, this record happened to capture that process of coming out of it, and it's recorded. And that's what's so beautiful about this thing. It starts in this place and it goes through all the dynamics of that and comes out this ending, which is kind of victorious. I have this whole nod to Ennio Morricone at the end, with Jennifer Jobe doing this operatic voice at the end of just triumph. And you know, I, no matter how you tell yourself at the time it's not going to happen, you always come out. I said it was years, and it's tough, and you have ups and downs and stuff like that, but you come out of it. And I found that, you know, it's always with yourself. You always bring yourself out of it. And the fact that the music, and I was able to capture that, just freaks me out. I think that's why I love this record so much, is because it's an intuitive process. And at the same time, it's vulnerable, but it's like, it's, it's exposing into this of the process of getting there. And that's like, it's hard to do. And I think the only reason it happened is because the way I write, I improvise, and you don't sit down and go to write songs like this and always take it from an improvised state. It's there. And then I'll flesh it out, obviously. But to get that on that record was, it's like one of these things, like, and it was so hard to get there too with the guys in the band because they weren't in the right. I was, this is the most undemocratic record I've ever made. I pretty much told them how it's going to be. And I've always been pretty open about that and left it open for everybody to kind of, they do write their own parts, but sometimes, but this one, it's, it was very specific on the sound. And, I just had a real, passion to get it there and almost trashed this thing four different times because it was so difficult, to get there. But, it happened. I'm so happy it did. It's like, if I don't ever make another record, I'm so glad I made this record.
Well, I feel like it's such an experience to listen to start to finish. Like, that's how it should be listened to. And I wonder if that's because it's almost like a real time picture of a man, you know, climbing out of a hole.
Yeah. I think it definitely has that tone, so much so that, you know, did you hear I was doing those listening experiences?
Yeah, I saw that. That was amazing.
So that was, you know, that was my kind of rebel against the phone, this jukebox we've got in our pocket where everybody's just listening to playlists, other people's ideas of what they should be listening to, and no one listens to albums anymore. And so it was like, I've got to figure out a way to have a captive audience to listen to this, man. So I was with some buddies, and I out in East Texas and Emory was laying out by the campfires at night, and I decided to play a record. It's from my high school buddies. And we played it, and it was like, man, this works so well in this environment. And I thought, I'll just take this thing, you know, out on the road and do these pop-up listening. I'll get some speakers and run them out there and do them pop-up, and people can show up. It's free. I have moving blankets for them to lay on. It's 360 degrees sound. And that's what I did. I just hopped, I rented a Sprinter van. I rented a sound system and had 12 speakers, 12 tripods, two generators. And it was just me and with blankets. And I just hauled ass across the country and started in Joshua Tree. And then the rest, I kind of went over the West Coast, just took my time. It was amazing.
That sounds pretty incredible. I got to say, from having heard the first song from the record that I heard on the big speakers, I hope people listen to it with headphones or at least listen super loud.
Yeah, please do listen, and listen to it as a whole, because it's an experience. It's supposed to be listened to as a whole. And if I could just, you know, make it one track on Apple, then I would have done it. I would have pissed people off.
They would not have liked that. So I wonder if you'd be willing to try and distill some of this wisdom you've been sharing. Imagine a 21-year-old version of yourself in today's world. And what advice do you think you might give that 21-year-old version of you?
So, Rhett, you were way ahead of me as far as like making music. You're younger than me, but you were like, you were making, I wasn't making original music at 21 years old. I was jamming, doing stuff with some friends, but I didn't really get focused till I was around 24, 25, somewhere in there is when I started Tripping Daisy. But, 21 years old, man, I think at that point I didn't even play. I wasn't even thinking of music. I moved to California out of high school at 18. Me and a friend just hauled ass and moved out there and just ended up having to sell clothes to live and lived on quarter burgers. And it was ridiculous. But 21 years old, man, you're still like trying to figure it out. Unless you've already got a pretty good idea. If there's something that's kind of gnawing in the back of your head that you want to do, that you wish you could do, that's trying to tell you that you obviously have this and you can do that. You just have to kind of start aligning it and find that where it just, for me, it just kind of hit me. Like I did an open mic with my friend in Crested. I also moved to Crested Butte, Colorado when I was in my early 20s before Tripping Daisy, where I had to ski to work every day. Worked on the mountain and had to be on the chairlift at 8 o'clock in the morning, ski down to Twister Warming Hut, and I managed the Warming Hut, me and my buddy. We just cranked music. But anyway, I did an open mic there with him. We had no idea what we were going to do at this community center in Crested Butte, and did this thing. And I've been just drifting in and out of life, just having experiences, not even really thinking about what I wanted to do or anything. But went there and we did this thing, and we didn't know what we were going to do. I said, just play something. We're in this black box theater and it's filled with people. And so he just played, and I just closed my eyes and just started singing. It just was happening, and it just made this thing up. And I completely was lost in my own world. I never even opened my eyes. And then it was over and it ended. And then I opened my eyes and I kind of like, wow, that was a trip. And I look out, it was just total silence. And then the place went crazy. They like stood up and were cheering. And it was like we had just done something. Like, it was amazing. I didn't even know. I had like caught in my ears at the time. I'm just like in what I was doing. I look at him, I hear this big goofy smile on his face. Stephen Burrill. You remember Stephen Burrill?
I know Stephen, yeah.
Stephen Burrill. And it was like getting hit with that wave of energy and just these people freaking out. I literally on that stage said, oh my God, what am I doing? I've got to get back to Dallas and start a band. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. So it's like, I had a lot of experiences in my early 20s and it was okay. I learned a lot and I just ventured out, and you know, you have your ups and downs, and that's just life. And being in your 20s, that the world can seem doom and gloom at times, but man, it's so wide open. It seems to switch on a dime when you're younger like that. But just, I say, just remain open, because you'll ultimately tell yourself what's going on. Listen to yourself, and then and find your way. It will happen. It just happens, because again, humans want to, they have a need and they want to be happy, and you're your own way of getting there. So just listen to yourself.
That's fantastic. It comes up over and over again in these conversations that what we have, musicians or maybe artists in general, that's our superpower is our instincts, right? Just what's the next chord? What's the next word? Where does the melody go next? So you're always following this thing, you know, like you said, turning on a dime. And why not apply that to your life? Why not trust your instincts?
Totally. There's a great book, Malcolm Gladwell, called Blink. They talks about that same thing. Just talk, feeling, understanding your gut instinct, understanding those, that voice that's going on, that's telling you these things. It's real. It's very real. And it can be, you know, chaos outside can kind of keep that quiet, but, listen to yourself, because you know exactly what you're supposed to be doing.
I love it. That's great. Well, that's a perfect way to wrap it up. I really appreciate you giving me and the listeners the time today. Thank you so much, Tim.
You bet. Thank you, Brad.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris. One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget, and we decide if they brought the One Hit Thunder or were nothing more than a one hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week, so pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.